This week on Writers, Inc.
The only way you're going to get better is stuff that you're not doing. It's not going to be the stuff you're already doing. So, yeah, but I don't give advice. I just say, you know, here's what I'm doing, and you may find it useful.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm J. Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome back home from Author Nation. Everybody's in their offices, got their real microphones in front of them. Everybody looks yeah. healthy and relaxed.
It was hard coming back. I'm not going to lie. It was, 75, 80 when we were there, and I came back to snow. I'm not a fan.
Yeah. All my dinners are very lonely now. When I go out to dinner, it's just me. It's
like, and cheaper, though, than Vegas and the $140 yeah. steaks. So
that's exactly right.
I bumped my flight up to business class for the trip back.
Nice.
Smart.
Yeah, that was fun.
Got to be comfy.
Yep.
Yeah. I miss you all.
It was fun, though. And this was the very first time that we had literally everybody involved in the show in one
place.
Yeah,
that was fun.
JP was there. Alex was there. Even like Alex's cohorts and his business were there.
So. Yeah. It was a bit surreal this year because I know we had quite a few people that came up to us and were like, oh, you're Writers, Inc. I listen every week. And I was like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we are. I'm getting my 3.5 minutes of fame. Thank you. Yeah. That was cool.
My marketing brain was kicking in, and I'm thinking we need, because we had this giant banner for J.D. Barker behind us. It was 7.5 by 7.5. So I ordered one for Writers, Inc. for next year. I've got a feeling we've got a lot more people that listen to this show there that probably had no clue we were in that particular corner.
Yeah.
Point of that booth to, you know, attract the readers, not necessarily other authors.
Readers can listen too.
Readers That's listen. Cool. Writers are readers.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, we honestly get a mix of both, I think, when we start digging down to the demographics, because a lot of the, you know, the fans of the people that we interview, you know, listen to the show. Yeah. But in general, I felt the con was a lot more dialed in. I mean, the crowd was definitely larger. Mm-hmm. You know, everything from the reader events to the speaking and the panels, I think it all felt a lot more tight than it did, you know, last year.
Yeah.
Which you know, and it was organized last year. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was fantastic. So I think it's just, they've got nowhere to go but up. And they're doubling down every year and just improving.
Yep. So I'll get 8x10 glossies of those Christmas cards I sent out with us all wearing funny hats, and we can have them signed. We can all sign them next year.
There you go. That's something to sign. Yeah. There you go. All right.
Kevin, what is in the news?
Well, first up, Amazon introduces Kindle Translate. Amazon is beta testing Kindle Translate for a select KDP authors. AI will translate ebooks from English to Spanish and German to English in a few days, with translated editions labeled in the Kindle store. For beta users, translations are free, pass a 7-step quality check, and authors can preview or auto-publish. They get standard KDP royalty options, global store availability, and eligibility for KDP Select and Kindle Unlimited. Amazon says fewer than 5% of titles on Amazon are available in more than one language. So this could unlock new audiences and earnings for indies, especially backlist, that would never be human translated.
Is anyone on the beta for this?
Not yet, but I should
check. No, I looked. I would never do it. I've got a fantastic publisher in Spanish, and they do great, so I wouldn't want to step on their toes. Yeah. I'm just trying to see where this is going to go from an industry standpoint, because I've got publishers all around the world. This could essentially cut them out. I don't see the quality being, you know, where it needs to be yet, but that's, you know, AI is improving so fast, it's going to get there.
Yeah.
But I've seen that, you know, like particular translators can make or break a book. So like Fourth Monkey's been on bestseller lists all around the world. The one country it didn't do well in was France. And we eventually circled back and we realized it was because the translation wasn't up to par with some of the other ones. So that's problematic. But a good translator can really make the title. And in a lot of countries, the translators themselves have followings. You know, just like audiobook narrators, a lot of people listen to a Scott Brick book mm-hmm. because he narrated it. Right. The translators have followings too. I don't know how this is going to play out, because if these books are no longer going to foreign publishers, that market could dry up. You know, in another 10 or 15 years, there may not be foreign publishers anymore.
Yeah. I've heard the first few rumblings in the last few weeks about this in the indie communities that I am in, of people more looking into it, looking for recommendations. I haven't heard about this. Yeah, I've heard a lot about Scribe Shadow, but then people also hiring a person along with that. So somehow that makes it more cost effective. I don't know. I haven't looked into it, but I am hearing it come up a lot.
My German translations probably, make quite a bit of money, so I wouldn't want to mess with that at all. But I, Spanish and other things are kind of open, especially with my backlist. So I could see doing it perhaps. I think this is probably aimed much more at the indie crowd than someone like you, JD. I don't think they're trying to lure you in. I think they're trying to lure in a Kevin Tomlinson who doesn't want to pay anybody. That's what.
Well, that could be. I mean, like I can see a translator running a book through AI first, and then, they know the language, so then they can go through and they can clean it up, which would be a huge time saver for them. So I see that working. I'm honestly curious about the quality control steps that are involved in something like this. And they've been very vague as far as what that is. I'm guessing that they're going to be, somebody is going to be putting a lot of eyeballs on the first couple of books to make sure that the reviews are solid. Because if this comes out of the gate and people are saying the translations are terrible, it's going to vanish. Yeah. So Amazon's going to be all over those initial ones. But I just don't see how they can do this on scale and quality in today's world. A couple of years from now, maybe, but I don't know about today.
Yeah. But they need test dummies to get it right. So that's what they love the indie authors for. We're just going to test them.
Square it away on your shoulders and then roll it out to everybody else.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Next up, the publishing industry gambled on me and lost. That's in quotes, by the way. Maria Kuznetsova recounts a whirlwind debut. Big auction, big five deal, then her imprint folded. She was, quote, orphaned and subsequent books underperformed, turning her strong start into a bad track that made editors skittish despite her best work. She argues the system gambles on debuts and unrealistic expectations, then punishes authors for sales driven by fragile infrastructure and lost champions, echoing wider industry critiques about how track records stifle second and third books. Kuznetsova believes many writers do their best, most complex work later, yet support shrinks after book one, pushing literary fiction toward indie and university presses, and forcing authors to cultivate smaller, devoted audiences. She's made peace with a different kind of success, teaching, publishing shorter work, championing other writers, and insists she's just getting started, even if future books earn less money than this essay.
This part of the industry is kind of flipped on its head. If you go back 10 years ago, they would buy a debut, they would put money behind it, they would cultivate that second novel, the third novel, and they would they would help an author build a brand. And in today's world, they're just not doing that anymore. They're buying up these debuts, and if they don't come out of the gate hard, they pull that marketing effort back on title two. And a lot of people are only getting one or two book deals now. They're not even signing longer deals. I'm not sure how that's going to play out.
I think I'm not sure before, but I know that I started hearing a lot about these cautionary tales like 7-8 years ago, because everyone wants that big debut six-figure deal. But there's all, I don't even know a saying in a lot of the business circles I ran in before, that the faster your success, the faster your fall in a lot of ways. And so it's always better to kind of ramp up than to spike, because you have nowhere to go. And I have talked to other authors and they'll say kind of the same thing, that you have 10 years to write your first book, 1 year to write your second. And that's a lot of pressure. And if you come out with a big deal, now that's even more pressure, because you have to sustain, you got to come out of the gate running and you have to sustain it. And then you have to also write your second book and you have to sustain that. And it's a lot of pressure all around. But we all like the shiny big deal. I don't know if it's always the best though for a long-term career.
Yeah, I definitely years ago, right? We know that a lot of authors, their first book wasn't their best book, but the publishers worked with them and they had a career, and maybe it was their seventh book or 10th book. Now it needs to be your first book. But I'm wondering, we were talking a few episodes ago about how the Amazon algorithm may be changing to reward more steady sales. So I wonder if that will have any kind of impact on traditional publishing.
Well, I think it kind of goes into like publishing is always a business. And I think if you get a big deal, it's not that every first book has to be a success. I do think that there are a lot of editors and publishers that do still work with debut authors and cultivate them. But earning out of a $5,000 advance or a $25,000 advance is a whole different ball game than, $100,000, $250,000, $500,000. That's a lot of books. And they can put a lot of money behind debuts, and there's no guarantee it's going to sell still. It could still not just pick up. So I do think that there is kind of a strategy if you're a debut author. Like, obviously, you want to get as good a deal as you can, but I also think that when it comes to negotiating, there are other things you can try to negotiate or that your agent can try to negotiate other than just that dollar amount, like marketing and like just different things. Because I know, I've seen major significant deal authors not get a lot of marketing. I've seen it. So I don't know why they would spend so much money on an advance and not market it, but I have seen it. So
You almost want to just advise people, like, if you get an advance, whatever dollar figure that is, earmark it entirely for marketing. Just
yeah.
use that to market your own book once the time comes. Because as nice as it is to kind of get that money up front, it'll go quick. But then I've had several deals now, like the deal with Spotify. Like they don't promote it. They don't do anything to promote those books. And so every now and then they'll do a thing where it's like, we've bundled all three books together and people can get them for $3 for the entire $90 set. I'm like, well, that's wonderful. I'm glad that people are getting my books cheap.
You can take control of this to some extent. So I got seven figures for my second book for The Fourth Monkey. And in that contract, my agent at the time actually negotiated a specific dollar amount towards marketing. And they spelled out, more or less what they were going to do from a marketing standpoint. So we had that carved in stone from the get-go. And from what I've seen, that usually does work on par. There's a certain percentage of the advance goes towards marketing. So if they pay a big dollar amount on that advance, they're going to put a lot of money behind marketing it so that they can recoup. But I think a lot of people, like, we need to remind the publishers, that it doesn't happen with the first novel every single time. I mean, Gone Girl was Gillian Flynn's third novel. Da Vinci Code, I think, was Dan's third or fourth novel. And they were all selling decent before that, but not those kind of numbers. So, like, you don't, it's rare to get that out of the gate. I think, as a general rule of thumb, every book should outsell the previous book, or at least outsell the average of your previous books if you've got a number of them out there. Just it's almost like a boat in the harbor. Like, that tide just needs to keep rising just a little bit each time. Your audience gets a little bit larger. The book buying public gets a little bit larger. Word of mouth spreads. As long as you get that going, I think that's honestly the best way to build a career. A nice and slow and steady rise versus that big spike that Jenna mentioned at the beginning, because it does come and go. Just, it leaves just as quickly as it comes.
Right. All this, by the way, is why these publishers are looking for authors who already have platforms, thriving, healthy platforms. And I get it. I totally get that. And I've spent all my career, that's basically been my business, is how do I get people on my mailing list? That's been my marketing approach. Has been the whole business. And I'm starting to kind of do a lot more stuff that's aimed at growing that again, because the tides have shifted. Like, ads aren't quite as effective as they used to be, and all the old tricks still work, but they weakened. Like, they're not quite as reliable as they once were. So I'm trying stuff. Like, I've got I'm doing a lot more content on YouTube now, and other things, just to kind of branch out and get a wider discovery. So
Well, that's honestly a very important point too, because I've got a lot of friends that, you know, they built a huge career at one particular publisher, and then they moved to another publisher, you know, let's say 10, 15 years in, and they didn't realize at the time, but like their first publisher owns their mailing list, owns their website, they own all those pieces. So when they move to the new publisher, they have to start over from zero.
Yeah.
So doing like what Kevin suggested, you know, take control of that. That's something you can do on your own. You should never be dependent on somebody else for that. You want to be mobile.
You can and should own your domain name and website, own your mailing list, own your social media. All that stuff should be yours. And if you have it managed by anybody, it's somebody you pay to manage it, not the publisher. That's just the smartest approach. So we got one more story, but I got to go find the window. Oh, there it is. All right. So Spotify introduces audiobook recaps feature. Spotify has rolled out a new audiobook feature called Recaps, offering short audio summaries that help listeners seamlessly return to an audiobook they've already started without needing to rewind or re-listen. When a listener returns to a story after a break, they can tap the recap button at the top of the audiobook page to hear a tailored summary of what's happened so far. They also note that the recaps use AI technology, but the audiobooks are not being used for LLM training purposes or voice generation, and recaps do not replicate narration or replace the original audiobook in any way.
I love this. We just got back from AuthorNation, and I listen to an audiobook every day when I'm running. I went out yesterday. I couldn't remember what book I was listening to last, you know, let alone where I was in the story. Like, being able to recap like this is going to be cool.
Yeah. I like that as a feature. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's neat. Sometimes I skip them when I'm watching TV, but if I've been away enough, I like them. So I feel like this is the same thing.
That's true. Yeah, that's exactly what this is like. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't listen to audiobooks on Spotify yet. Maybe I should start, but the experience wasn't great the last time I tried it. That was early days, though.
Yeah, so things get better. I don't listen to them on Spotify either, but this is interesting.
Yeah, I love you, Spotify. I don't mean to, I've like dogged on you twice so far in this conversation, but you guys are aces in my book.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
All right. JD, who's up this week?
So I wasn't sure we'd be able to air this, but I interviewed James Patterson at AuthorNation, and they were kind enough to agree to let us air it on the show. So James Patterson, more than a billion books sold. He's one of the world's best-selling authors. He's also one hell of a businessman. Talking to the guy live is a little bit like wrangling cats, but I think I got some decent information out of him. We had some fun. Here he is, James Patterson.
So first off, just from everybody in this room, we know you're under the weather. We truly appreciate the fact that you were willing to take some time out and make this happen with everything going on. So thank you.
First of all, I'm so sorry not to be there. I actually was looking forward to Vegas, the gambling, the mediocre comedy, the gambling, the bad music. And I wanted to mingle as well. I have COVID, and full disclosure, I had lung cancer a few years back. So, in fact, I had a CAT scan on Tuesday. No cats, but so they're careful with me, and I'm fine. But I other than the COVID, so I'm coughing, and I slept a lot this afternoon. But I'm happy to be here, and I'll talk till I drop or whatever the fuck happens here. But So anyway, thank you so much for being here, and I'm sorry that I can't be with you.
So before we get started, I want to see a show of hands. When you all heard that James Patterson would be part of this, how many of you had this thought, I'm going to find a way to write a book with that guy? Yeah, so there are a lot of hands
two
up.
People.
Yeah, I know you can't see it right now. All right, so I want to kick off with a couple of stats. And we have to really dig. Honestly, these numbers move so fast that we couldn't find a single person who was actually able to track it all. But over the course of your career, you sold nearly 500 million books. That's billion with a B. Do you know how many New York Times bestsellers you've had?
No, I don't really. I'm not a stat guy. I just kind of, my whole thing, JD, is when I do a project, I just want it I want to be proud of it at the end of it. And that's it. That's the only thing that drives me. There's been some, this is not my language, but it's been motivating me for the last couple of years, which is, and I think it's more true of younger people, people in college, than it is for me. But the language is, my time here is short. What can I do most beautifully? And when I do any projects, that's what I want to do. I took on two sort of co-writing things this year, and they both, well, actually a year ago, one of them is with Viola Davis. And we did a novel, and that's coming out in March, I think. And I love the way it turned out. You never know. As you know, JD, you hope they all will turn out great. And we've done a few, and some are better than others, just the way it happens. But the thing with Viola turned out really, really well. And the other one is, weirdly, with Mr. Beast. And we have a novel coming out in June. And I really, that was an interesting one. And I really liked meeting him. Mr. Beast has 5 times more followers than Taylor Swift. A lot more than Taylor Smith, whoever that is. So that's what drives me to do stuff, not the numbers. I don't give a shit.
All right. Well, I guess we'll move past the stats. So you're talking to a room full of writers. So I've got to ask the you know, question you probably heard a million times. Did you always want to be a writer?
I was always a good student. I wasn't a big reader. I went to Catholic grammar school and high school, and they just gave us the wrong books. My family then moved to Massachusetts. I started working at a mental hospital up there as an aide, and I worked a lot of double shifts, and I had a lot of time, especially the night shifts, to read. I used to go to Cambridge 3 or 4 times a week and just read. And it wasn't the kind of crap that I write. It was serious stuff, you know, Ulysses, whatever. And it just turned me on, and I started scribbling. So I was around 19 or so. I actually published the first book and won an Edgar when I was 26. So I was very, very lucky to get published and then to luck out with the award. Yeah. But I didn't always want to be a writer. In fact, to me, when I won the Edgar, I'll give you my whole speech right here. I guess I'm a writer now. And that's the way I felt about it, that I'd been published and I'd won an award. So I felt like, okay, I guess I'm a writer.
Well, I kind of want to get into the work ethic behind you, because you honestly run circles around me, and I'm half your age. That should not happen. But you went into advertising, right, at first, out of college?
Yeah, yes. But come on, dude. I've been clean for 30 years. You have to bring up that. That's ugly. That's a terrible thing to do.
What was your first position at the ad firm? And you were with J. Walter Thompson, which is one of the biggest ad
doorman.
Agencies.
Doorman. No, I was a junior copywriter. I remember when I got there. Well, you know, it's interesting. I have a nonfiction book out now, which I think they're going to give away. I don't know what the hell they're doing with it. Disrupt everything. And my whole life has been just one disruption after another. And in terms of advertising, I took no marketing courses or advertising courses, and I needed a job. I was in New York. I was living in this really crummy hotel. And I had a friend who was in advertising, and they said, you got to do a portfolio. So I did a portfolio, and I handed it in. And then I brought another portfolio the second week and another portfolio the third week. And they said, okay, well, this guy is kind of relentless, so we'll hire him. And the first day I got there, I started walking to the elevator at the Gray Bar building. And the guy who would hire me was standing right there. And I sort of paused, and the elevator door hit me in the head. So welcome to advertising. Yeah. But I did do that initially. Yeah. Yeah, paid the rent.
All right. So that's where you started. And then what was your final position at the ad agency?
Out. I was out. Yeah.
You love to downplay this. You started at the bottom of that ladder, and by the time you walked out the door, you were CEO.
I was CEO of J. Walter North America. And I'm ashamed, but as I said, I'm over it now.
Yeah, but
you know what? No, it was a pretty good thing. And what I did when I was in a position to hire. I only hired people who were talented and nice to be around. So, you know, that was a good thing. And we did, you know, we had one guy who we hired, he went on to be the head writer on Cheers. And, Another guy, he directed I, Tonya, and I'm so bad with names, but a really good director. He just did that Friends and Neighbors, that series. So we had a lot of talented people in there, and so that made it fun. And you're making these little movies, these 30-second movies, 60-second movies, whatever, and, you know, it was okay.
So do you think that's what your writing style, the short chapters and the quick pacing, do you think it came from having to tell a story in 30 seconds?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. It may be, but I don't think that was it. I just, as I said, the first book won an Edgar, and it was a lot of good sentences. It wasn't a great story, but it was, I think the sentences were good. and then the second book, the sentences sucked and the story sucked. And I just kept kind of learning and learning, and I'm still learning. And interesting thing from my point of view, JD, is that I did an autobiography during COVID. The last, you know, I actually didn't have COVID during COVID. Now I have it, and it's not COVID. In writing the autobiography, I started paying attention to the sentences again. And also the characters. People always go, well, you know, it's just short chapters. That really isn't what it's about with me. It's voice. And I mentioned the Viola Davis novel. And she said, James, she said, you would think that I get all these great characters to play, but I don't. And she said, the character that you've created in this novel, it is a really great character. And she's dying to play it. And I think really the key to the better of my books is the character. Alice Cross is a really interesting character. And I think, and I like what they've done with the series on Amazon with Idris, because it's more real. It's more Washington right now. And he's really great in Aldous. I said Edward, Aldous Hodge, because he's very intense. So in the detective part of it, he's appropriately intense. And then in terms of the kids, he's really good with the kids. And that's the two parts of Alice Cross. I mean, he's like a lot of us. He has to balance his work life with his home life. And of course, his work life is very intense, over the top. It's not realism. It's whatever the hell it is, overtopism. But he has to balance that. And Aldous does a great job at that. He's a really, really good. Morgan, it was a different bit with him because we couldn't do we could have, but it would have been a little, and it wouldn't have been a very effective, the family part. So that really never got into the movies. But that to me is an essential part of Alex. Jane Smith is another, I think, really, really cool, interesting character. So it's all about characters, and that's why you lost me. You left me a goodbye. I'm so bad with the names. With Tom Cruise, the woman, they won a couple of Academy Awards. Who am I talking about? Oh, she wanted to play Jane, but it's all about the characters. Michael Bennett. It's about to get picked up. Actually, there were three companies bidding on it. And Michael's an interesting character as well, with all those freaking kids, you know. It's amazing.
So I kind of want to dig into some of the older stuff. So you remember when you took your first novel out on submission? It was Thomas Berryman Number, right, was the first one?
Yeah, it was turned down by 31 publishers, turned it down. Then won an Edgar as Best First Mystery, so go figure. You know, I don't know. You know, it's one of those things. I think it was the only thing about some of the turndowns, they were kind of respectful, you know, like show us your next book or something like that. But it happened, you know, pretty quickly. And I was lucky. I got an agent, a young agent, and he got me caught up with a young editor, actually Thomas Crowell, which no longer exists as a publisher. And I worked with him for a month, and then he turned it down. But the agent said, don't worry, I'm going to sell it in a week or two. And they sold it to Little Brown. So it turned out okay.
All right. And that was 1976. And you wrote Along Came a Spider in 1993. So what was going on in between there?
A little dry spell. You were writing that whole time.
Right?
I wrote a bunch of shitty novels. I really hadn't figured it out, honestly. And with Alex Cross, the first one, I sat down and I said, okay, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? And I found that, you know, to some extent, I like writing in the first person. I was more comfortable with that. I concentrated on the sentences more. I concentrated more on character, Alex's character. I wrote a lot. And then what I did with that book actually is my outline was like 350 pages long. That's where, really where the short chapters came from, because I read that, the so-called outline, and I went, wow, this is pretty close to the book. And it was a lot of short chapters. And I just said, I'm going to kind of stick with this, and it's somewhat unusual. There were a couple of books that I read that sort of got me into that. Mr. and Mrs. Bridge and Mr. Bridge, Evan Connell Jr., short chapters, very witty. Jerzy Kaczynski, Steps and Painted Bird. There were a couple of his books that I also short chapters. And I kind of liked that style. When I was out with President Clinton, he'd always say, you know, the attention span of a butterfly is 9 seconds, and the attention span of humans is 8 seconds. So I don't know, whatever. So that's where the short chapters came from. It was a little bit of an accident in writing that outline. And I added maybe 100 pages to it, and that became Along Came a Spider.
You actually made a couple changes there. Alex Cross wasn't always Alex Cross, right?
Well, initially, yeah. In the first 50 pages, it was a woman. And I just wasn't quite comfortable with it, and I changed it to a man. With the Women's Murder Club, I felt more comfortable and ready to sort of write from a woman's point of view.
Okay, so you're at the advertising agency. You're writing these books in your spare time, which I can't
keep
imagine.
Bringing up the fucking advertising agency.
Well,
leave me alone.
Here's the thing.
Give me a break. Okay,
we've got a lot of people.
I was a bad guy for a while. You know?
We've got a lot of people in this room that are still working the day job. So you know they know where you are today, but I really want them to understand where you were back in the day.
No, I'm kidding. I joke around a lot.
I know this is
my first line is usually, "Hi, I'm Stephen King."
All right, so 1996. That's the year you actually quit the ad agency. Do you remember what spurred that decision? What was going through your head?
Is that what? Oh, that was it. Yeah. What happened? I'll give you the scene where it kind of happened. I was I had a house on the Jersey Shore on the ocean, and it was a Sunday, and I had to go back to New York for advertising stuff. And I'm like, oh shit! You know, it was a beautiful day, and I'm on the Garden State of the Jersey Turnpike, one of the two. And the traffic, it's like 5 miles an hour going back toward New York City. And on the other side of the highway, these cars are going by like about every 15 seconds. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. And after about an hour and a half of this, I said, you know, I'm not understanding. My life is going in the wrong direction. I need to get on the other side of the highway. That simple. My life is going in the wrong direction. I don't need to be doing this advertising thing. I need to get on the other side of the road, heading toward the sunshine and the beach and writing fiction. And at that point, I had a couple of bestsellers. So I had money enough, not big money, but good money. And, I felt some confidence that I could, you know, that I had a writing style now, that I could do more crosses. I could do other kinds of stories. And the confidence was a huge thing in terms of, I didn't have the confidence initially, I don't think. You grow up, my father grew up in a Newburgh poorhouse. His mother was a charwoman, and he didn't have a lot of confidence, and he didn't instill a lot of confidence in me. So I didn't have it. You know, I just didn't, I wasn't this cocky bastard that I am now.
I remember the first time we met, you showed me your office. And while we were walking in there, literally every shelf, every surface had a manuscript at some stage of development. You knew what was going on.
No, it's still there, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm looking this way, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4, I don't know what the hell there are, 25 different manuscripts that are in some stage of development. Now, some I do myself, and a lot, most of them, obviously, I do with other writers like you, JD, one of my faves. My most difficult... My most challenging, but one of my favorites.
I remember you pointing to a stack behind you. You said, that's something I'm working on with Bill Clinton. But the one thing that jumped out at me, you had a really old laptop sitting in the middle of your desk.
I was just with Bill Clinton, actually, because our agent lawyer died, and we went to his memorial. Unbelievable. It was 800 people for this thing, Bob Barnett's memorial. It was just so frigging emotional. Nobody needed to be there at this point. The Clintons were there. There were three presidents there: Fauci, the head of CNN, the head of Fox. It was three or four senators. Unbelievable! Yeah, everybody loved this guy. He was such a great person, and he hated to be called an agent. He liked to be called a lawyer. And I'm not that fond of lawyers or agents, so I used to call him my bookman or bookie. He preferred to be called bookie to agent.
So what's it like writing a book with somebody like Bill Clinton? I mean, this guy literally was the leader of the free world. He's sitting down. He's going to write a fiction novel with you. Does he take direction?
Well, you know, a piece of it for me is I just look at everybody as just another human being. So I'm respectful of President Clinton as a president. I'm respectful of Dolly Parton. I wrote a novel with her. But I'm like not overwhelmed with it. It's just another human being. And to me, the great thing about writing with President Clinton and Dolly is they're like best friends with me now. Bill and I, we exchanged Christmas and birthday presents. I think it was last year he gave me a humidor. And he knows I don't smoke for obviously reasons, because my lungs or whatever, you know, and my COVID. And I call him up. I said, well, you know, I don't smoke. So should I put, you know, bubble gum or chocolate cigars in here? He said, oh, bubble gum. He said, at our age, we got to exercise our teeth and our gums and stuff. But we're really pals. He called me this morning because he wanted to talk about the funeral, or not the funeral, but the memoriam for Bob. And with Dolly, same thing. I mean, we're just really good friends. First, when we were working together, I had a birthday, and she called up on the phone, and she sang happy birthday over the phone to me. And I wanted to say, Dolly, I want you to hang up now. I want you to call again, and you're going to get voicemail, and I want you to sing happy birthday again so I have a record of it. But I didn't have the nerve to do it, so I didn't do it, but... She gave me this guitar. I don't play, but she gave me this guitar, and she had done the artwork on it and had the name of the book where I was running. And then she wrote on it, "I will always love you, Dolly." And she calls me Jimmy James. That's her. Yeah. Anyway, but that's it. I'm into the human side of it. You know, my agent lawyer, I talk to him every day for 21 years, almost rarely about business. And when Bob, when he couldn't find me, you know, on the phone, he would say, you know, when he finally would reach me, he'd say, "I get nervous when I can't find you," and now I can't find Bob, you know. So that's a big blow. But most of these things for me, it's the personal thing, it's the relationship, it's the whatever the hell, you know, the specialness of it.
Can you walk us through just a normal day for you? You write every day, right?
I do 7 days a week. Yeah. Because I don't work for a living. In the beginning, yeah, it was, you know, you don't know whether you're going to get published. You don't know if it's good enough. You don't know if you're any good. You know, I don't have the problem of I'm not going to get published, or, you know, I can pretty much write what I want to write within reason. So I don't have those pressures. I don't really have financial pressures either. But I, as I said, I play for a living, and I love doing it. Because I'm always hoping that it'll be as good as I, and sometimes it isn't, but every time it's like I'm really excited about. And in some cases, you know, like with Disrupt Everything, the nonfiction thing, I just think it can do some good in the world. I went down to Vanderbilt. I gave a speech down there about, it was just, basically the power of disruption. And I think for a lot of the writers, I mean, same thing. I mean, my disruption, I started out, you know, you go into publishing and they go, you got to do your one book a year, and they wanted you to do it in the same month and whatever the hell. And I'm not going, well, I don't know what the hell's out. That didn't come down in the Ten Commandments. I don't, you know, where the hell did that rule come from? I go, I think I'd like to write more than one, and I don't know, maybe I can. And I remember going into the publisher. I had the two cross hits at this point. So they were listening. I said, look, this year I'd like to do an Alice Cross, and then I'd like to do this book called the Beach Road, I think it was, one of the beach things, a beach house. And then I'd like to do the Suzanne's Diary for Nicholas, a love story. And I told them the story. And when I told the outline for Suzanne's Diary for Nicholas, that the publisher started crying about, you know, just the way I was describing it. And then he said, well, we want to do the cross and we'll do the, you know, the beach house, but we don't want to do Suzanne's Diary because it, you know, it's not your brand. And I went, I don't know why you guys think you understand brands, because you don't know shit, your publishers. There's a lot of truth to that, sadly. But I said, I don't think of myself as a brand, but if there was one, I'd say basically, if you pick up one of my books, the pages are going to kind of turn themselves for better or worse, whatever that's supposed to mean. So if you're going to pick up one of my love story that I write, it's going to have pace. And so they reluctantly agreed to do Suzanne's Diary for Nicholas, and it's the second most successful book I ever wrote. So yeah, whatever. I don't know. I don't think of myself as a brand, but I do think it has to. You know, one of the things is a good pace to the books that I do, and that's a strength and a weakness.
Yeah, you prefer to work longhand, right? You write everything out in a notepad.
I do. Yeah.
There's two words that you told me you put at the top of every page. Can you just tell the audience?
Be there.
Be there. Can you explain that to these guys?
I just want to be in the scene. You know, if it's supposed to be scary, I should get a little frightened. I should feel it. If it's supposed to be, romantic, I should feel that way. I mean, where the hell it is? And then just keep writing it till you deliver on that for me. I never give advice. I have that thing on Masterclass. And I say, you know, right, and it's very successful. A lot of people, and it's actually a very good class, I think. And people like it more than all the writer classes because they test all this shit. And it's just, I don't give advice. I just say, here's what I do. And some of it may be useful for you. But the only thing I do say is if you're nodding to it, forget about it because you already do it. And if you're shaking your head a little bit that way, then pay more attention to that because the only way you're going to get better is stuff that you're not doing. It's not going to be the stuff you're already doing. So yeah, but I don't give advice. I just say, you know, here's what I'm doing and you may find it useful.
So one of the other things that I listened to your audiobook on the airplane on the way up here. So it was like you were actually literally in my head for a 6-hour flight. One of your philosophies that you mentioned.
You're already schizophrenic enough.
I am. Yeah. So that did not help. You added another voice. You said you like to leave out the parts that people skip.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you
explain? Well, that actually came from Elmore Leonard.
Okay.
That notion. And somebody asked him, like, you know, when did you start becoming successful? And he said, well, when I started leaving out the parts that people skim. Yeah.
All right.
So that was a little, actually, I was kind of doing that anyway, but then I read that thing from Elmore and I said, yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. And this gives me some encouragement to keep trying to do it.
Okay. I know we don't have a whole lot of time here, so we're going to go ahead and open it up for questions. So if everybody wants
okay,
to queue up.
Great. Yeah. Okay. If I pass out here, then just keep going. I'm so sorry to not be there. It drives me crazy because I didn't want to really see you assholes, but I wanted to gamble tonight. So, you know.
Okay. You've built one of the most successful storytelling engines in history that's both wildly creative and effective. After all the books, collaborations, and experiments, you've seen what lasts. If you had to burn it all down to start over, what's the one truth about storytelling that would survive the fire?
Yeah, no, that's great. I'd like to start where I am right now as opposed to where I started and then see what the next book is. And that's pretty much, I mean, okay, essentially that's what I'm doing right now. It is all the past is burnt down. And you know, as I said about, you know, like next year, this is my list of all the next year shit, you know. So the Judge Stone thing I'm really excited about that. There's a thing, Country Road Murders, that I did with Mike Lupica that I'm excited about. And then the thing with Mr. Beast. And then moving forward, you know, JD and I, we just finished a book. I won't give you the title, but that's an exciting one that we finished. And I think we're going to maybe start something else in the new year if one of us has a good idea. But essentially that's what I do. It's all burnt down. The past is the past. And then, okay, where do we go from here? What's the next thing it's always, you know, it's interesting. I did a nonfiction this year, The Idaho Four. And initially we have a deal with Skydance, out in Hollywood. And, David Ellison, you know, runs that and probably half of Hollywood now. And he was sort of stimulated. He kind of wanted to do something on the Idaho, the murders of those kids out in the University of Idaho. And I wasn't totally turned on to it at first. And then I started thinking about Truman Capote in Cold Blood and the notion of writing about those two college towns, Moscow, Idaho, and Pullman, Washington, where the killer was in school. And dealing with the kids out there and the effect that this thing had on the two towns and on the police force, and then the effect of the The online stuff, the terrible online stuff where they would accuse certain people of being the killer and stuff like that, and to write it that way rather than, you know, I didn't really want to write about Kohlberger very much, although we found out a bunch of stuff about him, Vicki Ward and I. Vicki was great. I mean, just she's a great reporter, good writer, and so, you know, so that wound up. I'm really happy the way it turned out, and they did a documentary on Prime, and I also thought that turned out great. They did a terrific job. It's just it's not like sleazy, you know, the way they do a lot of those, you know, like Filthy Rich we did on Netflix, and I never liked it. I always thought it was kind of boring and sleazy, and but the one on Idaho that Murders, I thought was really, really a classy piece.
Thank you for this opportunity. I'm curious what practices.
That was a really good question, but it is they're all behind me now. It's all burned down. It's all wasteland. T.S. Eliot. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I'm curious what practices you have found most helpful in creating authentic characters who have different identities and lived experiences than you.
Well, no, it's crucial. I don't know about practices. I mean, I'll just sit there and keep writing, you know, just bullets down, just things. There's a book coming out. I don't know when the hell it's coming out. I think next year. A thing I did with Lou. It's actually interesting the way it happened. Mike and I were on tour, and we just go out because we just enjoy being with him. He's kind of my best friend and one of my best friends now, and we just have a ball when we go out. And so we were down in Jersey, and it was a terrible day. It was raining. It was on the Jersey Shore, but you didn't want to be outside really. But Sue and my wife Sue, she was with us, and Mike, I said, "Come on, let's go walk on the beach." And I'm like. So I walked about, you know, halfway to the beach, and I'm drenched already. I said, you know, I don't want to do this. This is stupid. So I was walking back to the hotel, and this little old guy was riding on a bicycle into the wind and the rain and whatever. And I'm watching him, and for some reason, one word stuck in my mind, and I went back to the hotel, and I wrote about a four-page beginning of an outline about a book called The Traveler, and that was based on seeing this little old man on the bike. And that character that Mike and I developed, and we wrote three or four pages of just bullets about her. And she was somebody who had this incredible love-hate affair with New York City. And that really gave the book such a voice. I mean, just she would just sit there, you know, cursing for half a page about these freaking bicycle people that threatened to kill you every time you cross the street in New York. But, you know, just everything about New York, things that she loved, things she hated. And it gave it a real fresh voice, I thought. But every time, and J.D. knows this, I'm more that way than he is, I think. It's one of his strengths he still needs to develop. As he said, he's young. Is more on the character and just diving deeper into the character and more things. And what separates that character and what's interesting about the character? Why do I want to read about the character as opposed to just, you know, the story, the thriller part of it, you know?
Thank you for these great answers. They're inspiring me. But I'd love to know what inspires you and what...
Is there just one person in the audience? Oh, my God, that's so cool. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
And what do you want us to know about you?
You know, nothing. If you're curious, the autobiography is actually much better than you would think it would be. It's good. It really. I thought it might not be very good. I tell you, what happened was it was, as I said, during COVID, and I just started writing these stories, story after story after story. You know, for example, as I mentioned, my father, you know, grew up in the Newburgh poorhouse, and you know. And he was about to go off to World War II, and he got this call, and this guy said, you know, just bear with me for just a little bit. My name is George Hazelton. I live in Port Jervis, which was about 20 miles away. And he said, I'm about to go off into the Pacific Theater, you know, World War II. And, my mom and dad took me downstairs after dinner, and they said, listen, George, we love you so much, but you're going off to war, and we have to tell you that we're not your natural parents and you're adopted. And then over the phone, this guy said to my father, I'm your brother. And that's how my father found out I had a brother. They both survived the war, came back, became best friends, just best friends. And three or four years later, my uncle called again. He said, I found our father. I never, you know, the father had a reputation for being this sort of crumb bum Irish guy, a drunkard, whatever. And he said, he's tending bar in Poughkeepsie. Let's go see him. And my father said, I don't want to meet the bastard. So my uncle went up by himself, and he goes to this little bar in Poughkeepsie right by the bridge there across the Hudson. And it's this crummy little place, and there's a couple of, you know, rummies at the bar. And there's his father behind the bar, and my uncle didn't drink, so he orders a Coca-Cola. And he's watching this guy, and he's so turned off by him that 20 minutes later, he leaves without ever introducing himself to his father. And the book is just nothing but stories like that, one after the other after the other. And at one point early, I go for about a page on a Newberg, the way you would read a normal, one of these stories that gives you every friggin' detail about every town. And I said, if you're looking for that shit, don't look here, because I'm just going to tell stories. I'm not going to do one of these, you know, Newberg, the Revolutionary War and all that crap. And I said, that's not going to be here, but I'm just going to tell story after story, you know, advertising reluctantly, all the publishing stuff, all the publishing stories, et cetera, et cetera. What it was like to work with the various co-authors. I think actually as writers, I think you'll find it. I said to the publisher, I said, here's the marketing problem with the book. I mean, who the hell wants to read a book about me? But if you read the damn thing, you'll be surprised. But they sent out for quotes, and the quotes, they weren't like the normal stuff, you know, where people just trying to be nice. They were really stunning quotes. So I do, I shouldn't be recommending it, but it's worth considering. Buy one copy and just pass it around to your other writer. So, and then everybody puts in like a quarter or something. I don't know, whatever.
Good evening. You said a few moments ago that you don't give advice, but what do you wish that someone had told you about building a career as a writer?
Early on, pay a lot more attention to character, a whole lot more attention to character. Don't worry. I mean, I got tricked into, you know, like I wrote Black Market. I forget what we called it. Maybe it was Black Market about, oh, I'm going to blow up Wall Street. And I thought that was enough. I didn't research enough. I need to research a lot more so it was compelling and believable. And then I needed to put real people in there. I didn't. You know, that's what I wish somebody had told me. And beat me up a little bit about that very early. That would have been useful. And instead, they're going like, "Oh, yeah, that's a cool story, blowing up Wall Street." Okay, you know, but it just wasn't a really good story.
Hi, I did your master class online a few years ago. And you're right, it is fabulous. But what struck me the most was how funny you are. I didn't realize how funny you are. So my question is,
to be funny now? Okay.
If this whole writing if your whole writing gig doesn't work out for you, would you consider stand-up comedy?
No. No, but you know, it's one of the things about the humor side of it is, and you know, like I did a, I mentioned my agent, lawyer, and I love the guy. He was just so, and Clinton, both Clintons talked, and Bob Woodward talked, and there were a lot of big hitters in there, you know, and everybody said my thing was the best because it was fucking funny, and I cried, and for real, you know, and you can't beat that laughter and tears. There's a book, actually all my kids' books are funny. Alice Cross, he just isn't that funny a dude for whatever reason. There's a book in January, which I wrote with Susan Delisle, The Invisible Woman. And the idea of it is actually, I think, pretty cool, kind of. It's not a mystery, but it is funny, I think. And it's about a woman who gets sort of brushed out of the FBI. And she's kind of like, you know, semi-unemployed. And the guy who pushed her out really unfairly says, you know, I got a job for you. And if you do it, maybe I can get you back in. And I'm choosing you basically because you're invisible. And I want you to be this nanny at this house where we're watching. And we think the guy's involved with, the cartels and stuff like that. And it has to do with women of a certain age and men of a certain age. It's just you're invisible. Nobody sees you anymore. You know what I mean? So it's kind of a cool thing a lot of people don't identify with. I have a friend in New York, and when he was younger, he was like Al Pacino kind of dude, really popular. But he says, Jimmy, I walk along the street. The ladies, they just look right through me like I'm not even there anymore, you know? And I think a lot of people identify with it. I think it's a funny book. I think it's a true idea, and we chose to make it funny. So, yeah.
I was curious what kinds of things and stories keep you reading long past the time you should stop and just go to bed.
Me? Not as many as I'd like to. I'm reading the new Michael Connelly, which I like a lot. I'm reading my buddy Lupica. He keeps sending me his old books to read. Read this one. It was really good. I'm reading one of his, too. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's always a combination of characters that you want to keep reading about, things you got to know the answer. John Grisham is really good at setting the hook early. I got to read the rest of the book because he set the hook. He's not as compelling for me. As a storyteller, but he sets the hook so deep I have to read the damn thing no matter what. I think he's a good writer, but he's a little more leisurely than I'm that cool on. But I don't find that many right now. Lately I can't remember. I am enjoying the new Connelly. Connelly's really good. He's a good storyteller. He's good on real, he digs and he does his research. He's good at what he does. I don't know what anybody's read recently that you go like, ooh, you got to read that one. That one really pumps along, you know.
You have lived through and navigated some change in the publishing industry over your time in the industry. And through it all, you've maintained this amazing reader base that's always hungry for the next book. And so during our conference this week, we've all been talking about the pace of change. And I was wondering if you had any advice about for authors to maintain that reader base as we're navigating.
Oh, it's really, it's, yeah, you know, one of the things I don't want to give advice, but, you know, notions about if you want to keep paying the bills, it's good if you have a new book and you can tell somebody in a couple of sentences and they go, ooh, that sounds good. That really sounds great. I think that's really, really useful because ultimately the publisher is going to look at the thing and they're going to be thinking, all right, our salespeople got to go out there and sell this thing in a paragraph. I hate to say that, but I mean, that's really useful when you go like, yeah, oh, that's okay. That really sounds interesting for whatever the hell it is, the character or something about it where people just go like that sounds great. I think that's useful. I think more and more pace, you know, it's hard. I mean, you know, you do things like, what the hell was it? The thing in Ohio recently, that I just finished. I forget what the hell it is. Buckeye. Yeah, Buckeye. And that's not pacey at all, but it's just so, you know, very, very, very well written. But that's just a harder, I don't know. There's no really advice there. You know, write a great book and, you know, write Moby Dick. And, you know, although, you know, you write Moby Dick right now, probably won't get published. So it's tough. It's just very, very, very tough. You try so you can put stuff online, see if stuff are working. You know, that's another thing in terms of, you know, a little bit of, it's good to have a couple of readers that you really can trust. When I was in business, I always felt it was useful to have somebody around who would tell me I had shit in my hat. And that you don't do that in front of other people, but privately you can tell me, you know, or somebody who can read my books and be real honest about, okay, you know, it's the pace isn't very good, or I'm not really into the character, or I mean, with the co-writers, and JD knows this, I mean, one of the things I'll just be like, it's just going sideways, and JD goes sideways more than I'd like, but that's not the kind of books that I want to do. I want them to just keep moving forward. You know, Ulysses goes sideways a lot and it's great, but that's not what I want to do. When I'm working with somebody, I kind of know what I want it to be propulsive and keep moving forward, keep surprising you, keep the voice. I mean, losing the voice, that's another thing that we talk about, JD and I and other different writers, the voice, we've lost the voice, the voice of the character, the voice of the story. It's just, you know, it's not working. And, or, you know, one of the big problems if you're writing suspense is that people think they figured it out, and you can't go, oh, they think they figured it out, but they really haven't, and they'll find out 200 pages from now that they haven't. Well, yeah, but those 200 pages are going to be really painful when you're sitting here and you think you know where it's going, and it's not going to be saved, but 200 pages later you go, oh, shit, I didn't expect that. because it was so boring for 200 pages. So I don't know. A lot of stuff. And once again, no advice, but maybe some of this will be helpful.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Again, we appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So my first question is for you, JD. Do you know if Patterson survived? Is he alive? He didn't make it to Vegas. He got sick.
No, so I talked to him a couple of days before Author Nation. I think it was the Wednesday before we were all supposed to leave, and he was excited about coming. Then over the weekend, he started feeling a little down and under the weather. Went to the doctor and learned he had COVID. So obviously, they weren't going to let him on an airplane, fly halfway across the country. I did talk to him yesterday, though. He sounds a lot better. It sounds like he got everybody in his life sick, though, so now everybody around him has got COVID. But Jim is doing better.
It's a special, Patterson brand of COVID, though. So everyone's kind of proud to have it. And it doesn't, it makes sense that he brought in others for his COVID.
He brought in co-authors to be sick.
I told my brother that he wasn't at the conference because he got sick. And his immediate response was, I'd gladly get James Patterson's COVID.
Well, Kevin, was it you that said that would become a hashtag and start trending if he was actually there?
It was not me, but that does
sound
like
James Patterson's COVID. I think we could start that.
All right. So he talked about how he didn't always want to be a writer and he only realized he was one after publishing and winning an award. So how important do you think it is for writers to claim the identity of writer? And do you think that changes the approach they need to take for their craft and career?
I think he was a bit like me when he was coming up. Like, I had been told you can't make a living as an author. So I didn't even look at that as a career. But everything that I did, every time I had some kind of writing element to it, like that always seemed to shine a little brighter and people would point out, yeah, you're a good writer. You're good at this. You're good at that. So I think that really happened to him when he was working at the advertising agency.
Which he did not want to talk about.
He did not want to talk about it. And I had a conversation with him about this. We talked about it yesterday. We've got an auditorium full of authors, people that are coming up in the world, like they want to hear that origin story. But he kept falling back on it, and he did some iconic ad campaigns. Like he wrote the Toys R Us theme song. He was responsible for the burger wars between McDonald's and Burger King back in the day, that ended up turning into a huge court battle, which generated a ton of free publicity. right. But he was very good at creating those types of things. In his autobiography, he points out he's basically creating 30-second movies. You're forcing somebody to watch something they don't necessarily want to watch, and you have to get them to buy a product they didn't know they want to buy. And like when you come up in the world doing that, I think turning that into fiction, it's a huge leg up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I had the opposite experience because I didn't get any awards and people told me you suck at this, which was my whole motivation for becoming a writer. But I like that after you got that award, you asked him, JD, what happened between that debut and Along Came a Spider? Because there was a substantial number of years. Was it like 17 years or something?
17 years. Yeah, he didn't want to talk about that. Yeah, so Thomas Berryman his first novel was 1976, 78, something like that. Along Came a Spider was the early 90s. And he had been writing novels that entire time, turning them into his agent, turning them into editors and getting turned down over and over again. And it just makes me wonder, how many people in our circle would oh, you've actually got a copy of Thomas Berryman number. How many people would do that for 17 years and just keep at it and keep at it? Like the tenacity is ridiculous. But if he would have stopped, he wouldn't be here.
That's like my whole career.
Yeah.
I spent an entire career. Like I started writing and I guess technically I didn't publish anything until like 2006. And I had a trad deal and then I spent the next, decade not doing much, just continuously writing and publishing, but never breaking open. And then suddenly in 2016 is when things happen. So I think the people who are destined for it, I guess, I hate to even use that word, but I mean, the people that this is like your DNA, you're going to do it. And like, as far as claiming the title, like I literally have, my Substack is called The Writer. I put The Writer on all my branding and everything. I am all on board with, I'm going to own that as my identity.
Yeah. And I love what you said about the tenacity, because I think that's what it is. And he talked about it. He loves writing. Like when you tried to talk to him about stats and how much he sold, he's like, I don't care about that.
Yeah.
I don't look at that. I just love to write. And it's just like, you know, he's just a person, just like us. Yeah. He just loves writing. He's persistent. He's optimistic. I think that's all you can be in this business, you know?
Well, one of the things, he had two sayings in his autobiography that really jumped out at me. One of them was, he just keeps chopping wood. So no matter what life throws at him, he just keeps chopping wood. He just kind of puts his head down and just kind of keeps going. But if you think about it, you know, like I write every day because I like to write. Like it was happening before, it's going to happen after. The money really has nothing to do with it. This guy was the CEO of one of the largest ad agencies in New York for years, you know, so you know he was bringing home bank. He did not need to, you know, to toil over a novel. But that just shows how strong that driving force is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he talked about like burning it all down, starting fresh with every book. Every book's brand new, and he doesn't rely on his past success. So how do you keep your approach to writing fresh? You know, do you have like routines or mindsets or anything that you use when you get stuck in old patterns?
I think, like, from my standpoint, I've got a lot of people in my life telling me what I should write next. You know, I've got agents telling me they want this. I've got editors telling me they want that. They want me to fill a particular box every single time. And, like, I try to ignore all of that because that, you know, very much like he said, it's all based on the past. It doesn't necessarily dictate where you're going, you know, in the future. You know, so I tend to just focus on what I want to do next. And I try to do something, you know, outside the box, which is something I learned from him. I mean, if you look at the books that he's done, you know, he was selling really well as a thriller author. Then one day he decides to write a book with Bill Clinton and just expanded his audience by bringing in, you know, that entire segment of the world who may or may not have been reading him earlier. Mm-hmm. Then he, you know, writes a book with Dolly Parton. You know, again, it's like it seems as such an anomaly and such a weird thing. But she had a ridiculous following. So all of a sudden these people get folded into James Patterson's world and they're reading his books too. You know, he constantly expands his brand doing that. Like his latest project is with Mr. Beast. You know, and he brought this up on the interview. Mr. Beast has 5 times the following of Taylor Swift. You know, these are YouTube followers. There's a good chance a lot of them have never read a fiction book before. That's just not their you know, their mode of entertainment.
They're going to,
but now all of a sudden they're going to. That's the thing. And like and then they're going to discover that. Then they're going to discover who's this James Patterson guy. They're going to pick up other ones. You know, that's how you get to the point of where he is. And the guy has sold 500 million books. Like that's how you get there.
Yeah, and I loved what you asked him, that he puts on top of every manuscript when he's working on it, be there.
Yeah.
I changed in Scrivener where it says manuscript, now it says be there in all caps. I'm like, it's such a good mind frame to be in while you're writing. To actually be like, be the character, experience the moment. Are you seeing, hearing, smelling, feeling everything you should be?
Yeah.
That was a great
time. I like that as a kind of ritual. I have my own little rituals, I guess. I start every day by journaling, first of all, like, and it's just a stream of consciousness thing because it's kind of like momentum. Mm-hmm. Like as soon as I'm done with that, I open up Scrivener and I start writing, even though it has nothing to do with what I was just journaling. So do you guys have rituals? You got things you do?
I sit in the chair.
I sit in the chair and I write.
No, I don't. Yeah, I think I just grab my computer and just try to make it like a habit just to do it at the same time.
Yeah.
But no rituals.
I think that's more of a ritual than you think, though, because that concept comes up a lot with successful writers, is that they have a time. I sit down every day. I sit in the same spot. I wear the same baseball cap, you know, something like that. Or I used to actually do that. I had a Yankees cap that used to be my writer's cap. When that was on, I was writing. That's the only time I ever wore it.
I feel like mine is more chaotic than that. Like, it's not necessarily the same time. It's, like, roughly the same time a day. But it's not, like, you know, I don't know. It's
Well, do you play a certain music or drink coffee or, you know, you don't have anything?
I mean, sometimes tea, sometimes coffee, sometimes just water. Like, no, it's very chaotic.
That's your ritual then. You just sit there and raw dog the page.
There you go. Sometimes white noise if my house is noisy. I will listen to white noise. So,
My house is very much like Groundhog Day. It's literally exactly the same every day. I get my cup of coffee at the same time. My coffee mug is the same every single day. I sit in the exact same desk, sit down at the same time.
I don't know if it's because of all the travel we've done, but I will shake things up and go right from like coffee shops or hotel lobbies or whatever in the middle of the week, just a change of environment, because I'll get into a headspace, like a little bit of a fog that I need to shake myself out of sometimes. So,
yeah.
But I still consider that part of the ritual. It's like, okay, well, this is an outside day. I'm going
to
go play.
I just don't want to tie it too definitively to a certain set of things that have to be in place or I can't do it. So, I guess years as a single mother, you know, you can't predict anything. So you just like sort of learn how to like recognize within myself, like, there's like a feeling I have when it's like, it's very like creative, you know, like it's like, I'm kind of zoned in and to like seize that moment wherever it is kind of what I try. So I guess I try to focus on the internality of myself versus an external ritual.
Nice. Okay. With that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Richard Kirschenbaum coming on. Richard's the CEO and founder of NSG SWAT, a high-profile boutique branding agency he launched in 2011. His latest novel is called The Hollywood Fix, and it centers around the real star makers in Tinseltown, which are the fixers. I honestly love this behind-the-curtain kind of stuff, so this is going to be a lot of fun. Richard Kirschenbaum.
Yeah, it was a really fun conversation. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.